From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. China and the United States can look like best partners. The U.S. is China's best and biggest market, buys a quarter of all China's exports. China is America's biggest creditor, holds $1.2 trillion in U.S. debt, simpatico. But turn the coin, and there's a lot of rivalry here. Fierce hacking, hardball geopolitics. Cool war, says my guest today, Noah Feldman. Not cold, not hot, cool. With a lot to gain and a lot to lose. This hour on Point, the United States, China, and cool war. You can join us on air or online with this conversation never ends. Where does this go? Friends? Enemies? Frenemies? How can the U.S. and China be big, brawny, successful, and good partners? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Noah Feldman joins us in a moment. But first, for the latest on this week's report of the high-level hacking theft of top U.S. weapons designs is John Reed, national security reporter for Foreign Policy Magazine. John Reed, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we had the news a while ago now that there was this hacking going on. But then the Washington Post came out yesterday with specifics, and they were pretty eye-popping. What's the claim here, John?
The claim is basically that for years and years, Chinese military hackers have been infiltrating the Pentagon's networks, defense contractors' networks, to learn everything they can about just about all of our premier weapon systems. And some say this is their attempt to leapfrog ahead, to go from having a pretty backwards military to a 21st century military. And others say they want to know, you know, how we'll use our weapons and how they could possibly thwart our weapons. So it's probably some combination of all of these things.
This is a Washington Post report that goes to a report by the Defense Science Board we had already heard about, but they got more details. They got details that were left out when this was first reported. And what are some of the weapon systems that Chinese hackers have allegedly downloaded or hacked into and stolen the blueprints for?
We don't know specifically what they got, but it seems like they were looking for the designs, the plans, and that makes sense when you see, you know, they access the F-35, our premier fighter jet. Well, it's supposed to be. And a few years ago, the reports came out the Chinese hackers had broke into the designs for that. And then last year, we saw a fighter jet come out in China, the J-31, that looked an awful lot like an F-35. So that's that kind of leap ahead. They also looked at things like our ballistic missile defense systems. That's pretty critical when we want to protect ourselves from ballistic missiles, protect our allies in the region, everything.
Like the Navy's Aegis system. There's the Patriot missile system was also among these. The very latest form of it, the PAC-3.
Exactly. And even UAVs.
UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, so exactly. Drone designs, FA-18 fighter jet, V-22 Osprey, Black Hawk helicopter, the Navy's new littoral combat ship. Now, the way this is being reported is that designs have been stolen. You're saying that's not clear?
Well, we're not going to know exactly what they got because it's going to be classified. They don't want to, you know, I think that's going to take a while, but the reports seem to indicate that they were looking at the designs for this. We don't know how much they got, what they were able to do with it so far. But if you look at if you have access to the designs, and this matches a trend we've seen for a long time, where they go after a strategic interest of theirs, and they look at it and they try to hack into U.S. businesses that produce this kind of technology, whether it's engines, whether it's avionics for airplanes, whether it's communications gear, whether it's stealth technology, and then we see them develop something very similar a few years later. You see it in a lot of aircraft. You see it with UAV drone development. You see it in stealth fighters and the like.
We're talking about billions, or we've been talking about billions in value sort of picked up here, but maybe more than that. I mean, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter alone on track to cost about $1.4 trillion. We're reading military observers saying the Chinese, if they really got all these designs, could have gained like 25 years of development time and billions, I don't know, trillions in value out of this.
Exactly. It's, you know, they went from just a few years ago, former Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the PLA was about 20 years behind the U.S. military technologically. That was about 2 years ago. In those 2 years, we've seen two stealth fighter jets emerged, an aircraft carrier, all sorts of modernization efforts. A stealth drone has emerged. So it appears that they're using this to catch up quickly.
The Pentagon is saying that this doesn't really ding the effectiveness of these weapons. Does that look like just, don't worry, there's no problem here, or could that possibly be?
Well, that's the big question. That's what they publicly said yesterday. And a lot of the information in the Defense Science Board report was several years old. So who knows what we have done? You know, there's been an explosion in awareness about cybersecurity and Chinese hacking in Washington in the past 2-3 years, really over the past 5 years, but really in the last couple of years. Everybody's become aware of it, and so you're seeing a lot more focus put into how do we remedy the problem. And it's a broad approach. You know, it's no one thing, from better firewalls to scanning for intrusions on your network to calling China out on their hacking and saying don't do that, to potentially, you know, putting bad in, I've heard people discuss put bad information on your network so that when the Chinese hackers go to get that information, they think it's your crown jewels, and oops, it's actually really useless.
But it's a little late, it would appear, on these top weapon systems, with the reporting suggesting that the hacking was done not on the Pentagon itself, perhaps, but on the contractors who made these. President Obama sitting down with Chinese President Xi Jinping next week, and the White House already saying this will be on the agenda. But does anybody think you can talk the Chinese back from this kind of hacking?
Well, that's the other debate. I mean, we've started calling them out on it publicly. We've been reporting on this for years and years, and people say, why should it stop? Why will it stop? What do you do when the Chinese just say, no, we have no interest in stopping? That's where people say we need to have some sort of – some people say we need a cyber deterrence force. So if you have a big cyber attack, we're going to hit you back. Or you need to plant bad information in your networks so that they get, you know, it's just not worth it for them to do this hacking. Or you need to better protect your networks. Or you need to come up with international kind of rules of the road. It's probably some combination of all of those things.
Well, damage may be done here on this particular front, or many fronts, if these latest reports are to be believed. John Reed is national security reporter for Foreign Policy magazine. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
On May 6th, David Helvey, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for East Asia, talked about China's military, accused them of targeting computers in the United States, including government computers, as part of an ongoing cyber war effort.
China's military continues to explore the role of military operations in cyberspace as a feature of modern warfare. In 2012, numerous computer systems around the world, including those owned by the United States government, continued to be targeted for intrusions, some of which appear to be attributable directly to PRC government and military organizations.
Really? China likes to say no. In March, questioned by reporters, the new Chinese Premier Li Keqiang rejected U.S. accusations of hacking, called the accusations groundless, interpreted here by Voice of America.
China does not support. Indeed, we are opposed to such activities. In your question, I sense the presumption of guilt. I think we should not make groundless accusations against each other and spend more time doing practical things that will contribute to cybersecurity.
Right there, the flavor of what some are now calling cool war. Joining me in the studio is Noah Feldman, big thinker and writer, professor at Harvard Law School. He was senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. His new book on the United States and China is Cool War, the Future of Global Competition. Noah Feldman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Cool as opposed to Cold War? You're not trying to suggest a recreation of the United States-Soviet Union dynamic? It's something different?
It's not exactly the same. You know, as we were just hearing, when it comes to espionage, stealing technology, and a potential arms race, it is reminiscent of the Cold War. But the huge difference is that unlike the Soviet Union and the United States, China and the U.S. are totally interdependent economically. We buy a quarter of their products. That means they can't make it economically at this stage without us. And they lend us a substantial amount of money. They own 8% of all of our outstanding debt, which is larger than any other entity except for the Fed and the Social Security Administration, which is essentially our government.
So why put the word war into this label at all when there's such a deep kind of partnership right there?
Precisely because, as we just heard that Defense Department official saying, both China and the United States are taking steps towards each other that fit into the classic definition of conflict. They are stealing our weapons systems. We are doubtless trying to do the same to them and interfere with them to the extent that we can. And in some cases, like North Korea and South Korea, we have allies and they have allies that actually are shooting at each other on occasion. Arguably, the same may even be true with respect to Iran and Israel, which are not shooting at each other now but could conceivably do so. Again, Iran is a Chinese ally. Israel is our ally. And Iran, you know, is only one example of a country that we think of as a bad actor whose freedom of maneuver in the international sphere has a lot to do with support from China. So most fundamentally, we're talking about two great powers that are treating each other increasingly in the way that hostile powers treat each other. At the same time, they still have this rich economic relationship. But and that's why it's not a pure war, mm-hmm. in the same way that in the Cold War, we didn't actively shoot at one another except in proxies.
No, but in the Cold War, there was a sense that one of these sides would have to win. It would be, you know, it would be the Soviets' way or the U.S. way. Here you're saying, no, not necessarily. We may ride through this for many years, decades even, and come out with some kind of new relationship.
This could last a long time. In fact, it's certain to, because China is unlikely to experience a radical fallback from the kind of growth that they've had. They would like to be, and they show every evidence of wanting to be treated as a global power commensurate with their economic strength. You know, Xi Jinping just said in advance of his meeting with President Obama, we want, and I'm quoting, a new type of great power relationship. Mm-hmm. So he is saying we don't expect to be second tier forever. We do want to be treated as a great power alongside the United States. Meanwhile, the sole global superpower like the United States is unlikely to give up its position as the sole superpower without a fight. We don't have any historical examples of power saying, well, we're happy to step aside.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about conflict and codependence between the United States and China. My guest is Noah Feldman. His big new book is Cool War, The Future of Global Competition. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Next week, President Obama and China's new President Xi Jinping meet in California to talk about the world and the relationship. They've already been thinking about it in advance of that meeting. Back in March, Xi Jinping talked in China. He was meeting with U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, and at that meeting was making a few remarks interpreted here by Voice of America.
I attach great importance to China's relationship with the United States, and we are willing to work with the U.S. side to continue to develop this China-U.S. cooperative partnership and pursue a path to cooperation between two major countries.
Sweetness and light, path to cooperation, but there's a lot on the table. President Obama was talking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos the same month about China's cyber attacks against the United States. President Obama said the U.S. is concerned about those attacks, and they've already had some pretty tough talks about them.
What is absolutely true is that we have seen a steady ramping up of cybersecurity threats. Some are state-sponsored. Some are just sponsored by criminals.
But some are state-sponsored.
Absolutely. And this is why I've taken some very aggressive executive actions, but we need Congress to act. We've made very clear to China and some other state actors that we expect them to follow international norms and abide by international rules. And we'll have some pretty tough talk with them. We already have.
You can feel the tension right there. My guest Noah Feldman calls it Cool War, the title of his new book. You say, Noah Feldman, the debate is over whether to try and contain China or engage it. What do you mean by engage in that sense?
Engaging means deepening the cooperation that we already have. It means making the trade ties that currently exist better. It means lowering trade barriers between our countries over time. It also means bringing regional players in Asia into our sphere of trade influence, while simultaneously those same exact countries are getting closer and closer to China in terms of trade. So those are all ways to make us more interdependent. And that's a good thing, because the more interdependent we are, the harder it is to fight, because the more costly it would be to get into a fight.
You call containment the road to conflict.
Containment begins with the assumption that conflict is inevitable. Containment says, look, there are great powers and then there are rising powers. And if Germany is rising and Britain is the sole global superpower, that means there is going to be a conflict. And if you believe that there are sort of almost iron laws of history that have to do with powers like that, then what you need to do is convince the other side that it cannot become a great power, because then it won't try. That's the sort of post-World War II lesson. Germany left to grow and challenge the rest of Europe, did so. after World War II. It was blocked from being able to do that. Germany was demilitarized. And what do you know? It grew economically without growing militarily in the post-World War II period because it couldn't. So containment means communicating to the other side that you might be growing, but we won't let you become a true global superpower in the hopes of changing their incentives so that they won't try to become one.
Is China persuadable of that kind of future, something less than the sort of new type of great power relationship Xi Jinping's talking about?
I think it would be difficult at this stage to convince a China that sees its economy still growing fast, that imagines perhaps having the world's largest economy in a decade or two, that it won't be comparable to the United States, at least in its regional capacities within Asia. So I don't think it's possible fully to convince China in that sense that it should cease trying to grow its military. What might be possible would be to say, well, look, you may be able to catch up with us technologically, but you will not, in the short term, be able to generate an army that could actually take on ours. And so don't try to do that. Try to deepen economic growth. Don't overspend militarily. Don't put us in a situation of conflict where we all would lose. Because we, of course, all would lose if this conflict, which is sort of in Kuwait now, were to become more explicit and actually lead to violence. So the goal, I think, really needs to be to build up the benefits of the relationship in order to reduce the likelihood of real conflict emerging.
Which way do you see this trending right now? Xi Jinping and Barack Obama will sit down next week, and against the backdrop of this pretty tough hacking news, I mean, it really gets your attention. This is serious stuff. So are we trending toward conflict or tending toward engagement? I mean, the irony is throughout, we're doing both, but yep. Which way are the scales tipping in recent time?
We're at a very delicate moment now. You know, if these reports are accurate, and they seem, there's every reason to believe that they are, we're actually trending in a dangerous conflict-driven direction because of the extent of this cyber warfare. And make no mistake about it, this is warfare of a new kind, of a new form.
You steal the blueprints to somebody's top-level weapons.
There's only two reasons to be doing
business.
That. Exactly. To make your own and to stop theirs from working. Essentially, to change the great power relationship,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, it's not a secret. That's exactly what they say they're doing, mm-hmm. and they're taking the action that's appropriate for doing that. That's why President Obama's reaction and our reaction collectively is hugely important at this stage. Because if we could communicate that we are very serious about this, that we think this is bad, that we think it's a potential, has the potential for the integrate conflict, that might be a signal to the Chinese to back down. The Chinese will be watching extremely carefully to see how strong our reaction is. And so this is really a juncture point where if you believe that countries can be deterred from continuing to become dominant global powers by being afraid of what they might lose, this is the moment to say you will lose a lot if you go down this road, and we're tough enough to take you there.
Well, but what about that? I mean, what are the words that the President Obama of the United States could say or the muscle it could flex that would make this rising China say, oh boy, we better pipe down here?
Well, they have to be chosen carefully because we do have this cooperative
relationship. I can't even picture what they would be. We owe them all that money. They've got a lot of technology. They've got a giant and growing economy. Do we really have the levers to pull that would make them stand back in awe and say, okay, America, you're number one alone forever. We stand down. We're going to be like Germany.
Well, they're risky levers to pull, but they exist. And they have to do with China's dependence on us in terms of its export markets. We have to say something along the lines of, and it has to be formulated very precisely and very carefully, the United States sees attacks like these as aggressive and as dangerously tending in the direction of war. And then we have to say, and war tends to break down ties of trade and positive economic relations. We have to explicitly say
wow.
that we are capable of linking. We have to say that we're capable of
yeah.
linking the tremendous economic benefits that China obtains from its relationship with us to what they're doing in the security front to change their strategic calculus, to make them say, well, look, you know, we would like to have all this information if we can get away with it,
mm-hmm.
but maybe we won't be able to get away with it. Maybe it'll be too costly.
Two things. Are we in fact capable of making that kind of threat and following through on it? I mean, Walmart's full of Chinese goods, and not only there, high-tech goods as well now from China. Can the U.S. really convincingly say, hey, stop it, or we're not taking your stuff?
You know, we're perceived globally to be beholden to our consumer economy. You know, the idea is if the
yep.
television gets a little more expensive, people will be angry with whoever's yep. in office. We may need to realize that we have to slowly change our attitude towards that. We have to realize that paying a little bit more for consumer goods might actually be necessary to maintaining our national security. And I think many Americans would accept that if it were stated to them in that way. And I think that's the kind of subtle threat that we're capable of issuing.
Let's look at the Chinese Communist Party. They're in charge there. And the country that they are ruling, I guess, remains the word. Is it persuadable? There is a lot of nationalism on the Chinese side, a lot.
The Chinese side unquestionably has strong national pride, much as we have strong national pride, and that's probably the biggest driver of potential conflict. That said, the power of the Communist Party has depended for legitimacy on the fact that it has generated so much economic growth. And so the weak spot of the Chinese Communist Party is that if it can't generate growth, if it cannot maintain jobs and improvements for the people who have been benefiting from it, then its legitimacy is undercut. So that is our leverage point for trying to convince the communists, that is to say the governing party, which is not deeply communist anymore, but certainly it's a state-run
capitalism. Still the name of the party.
Still the name of the party, that they actually need to take our concerns seriously. They really are vulnerable on the limitations on growth, and growth can be limited if there's trouble in the space of export. So that's a, you know, again, this has to be handled very delicately. You don't want to get their backs up, but it is, in fact, our best and probably our only real leverage point.
Stakes could not be higher. President Obama and China's President Xi Jinping sitting down next week. Xi Jinping, I think we heard him just yesterday saying that China is at a critical point in its relationship with the United States. Noah Feldman writes about all of it in his new book, Cool War. He's with me in the studio. Noah, let me bring our listeners in. Camille in Charleston, South Carolina is calling. Camille, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a question. Basically, what I'm understanding and have noticed myself, this is asymmetrical warfare with the mechanics of capitalism being used as a weapon instead of a bomb.
In a way? Yes?
That's what I see.
Yeah?
Now, the title Cool War, the Chinese think in terms of 1,000 years ahead, not 100, not 2 or 3 quarters. How far has the author gone back to see when this may have strategically started on the Chinese end?
Let us go there, Camille. Thank you. Noah Feldman?
You know, China's collective experience in the period of the rise of the British Empire was of their own decline. And China has spoken, since the Communist Party came to power, of a century of humiliation, which they experienced when the West really dominated them. And that's something that has been the goal of the Communist Party to overcome for the last 50 years, and it started very slowly. You know, Mao's economic policies turned out to be so disastrous. They cost the lives of somewhere between 20 and 30 million Chinese because of the incapacity of the system to act rationally. Once Deng Xiaoping began to institute slow and careful economic reforms, the economy began to gather steam. And then, as you know, for the last decade, it's really been flying. That suddenly puts China in a position to return to what I agree with Camille, it thinks of as its traditional place, as certainly the dominant power in Asia, which is where it was for the better part of a millennium. But it took a while to get back there.
Worth bearing in mind that the name China itself, Chonghua, means middle kingdom, the center, as in kind of the center of the universe.
Yeah, exactly. And although I don't think China feels that it needs to dominate the Western Hemisphere, if China becomes the dominant regional security power in Asia, that's more than half the world by population. It's more than half the world by GDP. That means that China is de facto one of the two great global superpowers. And that, I think, is sufficient from China's perspective. It doesn't have a need to dominate Latin America.
You've outlined scenarios where it doesn't have to go far from home at all to make the point. The U.S. remains committed to the independence of Taiwan. It's just across the narrow Taiwan Straits from China. China, of course, continues to claim it. Taiwan's government recently talking about independence. Now, if China were to make a move on Taiwan, they could call the U.S. bluff on this in a hurry. And you say, would the U.S. really be willing to go in there, hammer and tongs, to secure the independence of Taiwan? And if it did not, that could be the moment, as with, Britain and the Suez.
I think each of us has to ask himself or herself, what would you say if you heard that our choice was allowing Taiwan to be made part of China or going to war with China to protect Taiwan? I think it's already in doubt as to whether the public in the United States would support such a war. But of course, from China's perspective, the most sophisticated thing to do would not be to invade one day. It would be simply to grow their military to the point where the question disappears, where it fades away. And that's exactly what China did with respect to Hong Kong, where they eventually told Margaret Thatcher, you know, we'll be taking Hong Kong back now, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing that she could realistically do about it.
Because the power had swung that way.
So drastically, it would never have been a plausible thing. It's not as though she was afraid of going to war. She did go to war to preserve a vestige of the British Empire in the Falklands, but China was not Argentina. You know, Argentina could be defeated by Britain, as indeed it was, but China wasn't even the beginning of a possibility to fight such a war. So you know, the Chinese offered a fig leaf. They said that Hong Kong would be part of China, but there would be two systems, so one state, two systems.
Yeah.
That's the exact same fig leaf that they now offer on Taiwan.
Well, play that out. If that card is played by China and the U.S. does not ardently resist it, how do the cookies crumble from there? What were the implications?
The implication is that the United States would have to explain to South Korea and to Japan, our major regional allies, and perhaps to Australia as well.
With whom we also have defense treaties.
Exactly. We have treaties with each
of
them.
Elemental to their sort of existence.
Without which they become adjuncts to China in some sense. That we will protect them, even though we wouldn't protect Taiwan. And Taiwan, of course, you know, is a country that is a democracy, which has its own economy, and where many people, 47% in the last elections, actually want independence from China.
Yeah.
So, you know,
would that be
our theory about how we would distinguish these things? We'd have to say, well, historically, Taiwan is actually part of China. We'd ironically have to say everything that China says about Taiwan. And if we didn't, it wouldn't be credible. And I think, you know, the time to worry about this if you're Japan or South Korea is actually now.
Yeah.
Because it's already possible to imagine that we would back away from Taiwan. So we need to assert our position in the Pacific. And I think, you know, the Obama administration's quote-unquote pivot to the Pacific was a sort of initial attempt to say to our allies in the region, don't worry, we haven't given up on you. And they will be watching the summit between Xi and Obama more closely than anybody because they are the ones who are most immediately affected by it.
And if they don't buy that the United States is going to stay eminent, if not preeminent, in East Asia, what are the implications? Where do they go as you play it out?
They have nowhere really to go except to accept regional hegemony by China. I mean, in the short term, they'll probably build up their own military capacity. And we've actually signaled to Japan that we're open to the idea that maybe Japan doesn't want to be a pacifist power anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something they could potentially do. And we see this when they're posturing with each other over the small islands around China that are symbolically significant because of what they say about who's going to be dominant in the region. But in the end, you know, what both South Korea and Japan have done is deepen economic ties with China, deepen their trade ties with China, while maintaining security relationship with us. And that's a very delicate game to play.
Sure.
And over time, if they can't rely on us for security, they will have to reorient themselves towards China and try to negotiate security arrangements in which they will have a lot less autonomy vis-a-vis China than they presently do. And I think it makes them extremely nervous.
You paint a picture of this kind of patchwork quilt of alliances, security, and trade being global. There was a Cold War map of the world, which you could draw a pretty clear line through. You were allied one way or the other. You say this will be more subtle, more nuanced.
Much more subtle, because you could be now, as Japan and South Korea are, engage in active negotiations with China over a free trade zone while simultaneously being close to going to war with China, as Japan has been, over the Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands. You know, both sides have scrambled jets towards each other, and yet the negotiations go on at the same time. So this is why the idea of a cool war is really distinctive. It's not just a Cold War. It's something distinctive because you can simultaneously cooperate with somebody and almost be on a war footing with them. And that's a very strange and paradoxical relationship.
At every moment, have everything to gain and almost everything to lose. You make it clear, if it goes to that fighting side, this is a disaster for everybody. Camille says, you know, people can give China a lot of credit sometimes. They think 1,000 years ahead. Are they really farsighted on this, or is it being driven by nationalism and the thrill of being back in the saddle?
It's one thing to think 1,000 years behind, to be aware of your deep history. It's another thing to imagine a future. And I don't think that anyone actually can imagine what his or her country will look like in 1,000 years. I do think China can look ahead 25 years and say, well, gee, we're probably going to be the world's biggest economy at that time. We'll still have all sorts of troubles. China will still be plagued by environmental problems. They'll be plagued by the question of unstable regions. There's still the problem of corruption, which is very threatening to the legitimacy of the party. I'm not suggesting here at all that China doesn't face enormous challenges, but so are we. You know, we have long-term unfunded mandates. We don't have. We would love to have 7.5% growth and have our biggest worry be what would happen if it went down to 6%.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about conflict and codependence between the United States and China. My guest is Noah Feldman. His new book is Cool War, The Future of Global Competition. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You should check it out. Really interesting depiction of where we are, kind of getting us up to date. This isn't just the post-Cold War period anymore. We're in a new century. We've got new dynamics emerging, and the stakes could not be higher. Noah Feldman joins me in the studio. Noah, I'm struck in the comments online. They're all over, but there's a thread that goes through here. Gary writes, he says on Facebook, "There's no competition. China has us beat. We just haven't realized it yet." What do you say?
No, I don't think that's happened yet. And there are a range of reasons for that. The first is that in terms of traditional old-fashioned global military might, we are still significantly ahead of China. You know, China bought an aircraft carrier from a former Soviet aircraft carrier, and they're refitting it. But it's not going to be anything like our fleet of aircraft carriers.
Yeah, but what? Are we really going to deploy those against the billion-plus people of China and then just see what happens?
Well, we already have aircraft carriers that are not that far from – that are in the Pacific.
That's different than actually using them. Do you think China believes we would actually deploy against China and then wait while they turn their factories into munitions factories and off we go?
Well, I don't think China thinks that that would be in its interests. So the question is not really whether we would attack them. It's what would they gain in the process? You know, if they had to change their factories into munitions factories, that means they wouldn't be earning. If they weren't earning, their economy wouldn't be growing. And if they weren't growing, the Chinese Communist Party, which has given up its ideological source of legitimacy because no one believes in communism anymore, would no longer be in charge. So you have to see it in terms of the motivations of the senior leadership there.
Right.
They want to continue to grow and they would lose a lot. And, you know, that's the reason that people often don't go to war with each other because there's too much to lose. Something might be gained, but there's too much to lose. There's also the question of what would the Chinese gain in such a war? You know, they're better off probably allowing things just to progress slowly but surely. And, you know, pride is an important value, but it's not necessarily worth the deaths of many people or the turning back of extraordinary economic progress. Another reason that we're not already behind China is that our system of governance, for all of its flaws, and we do have many, basically manages transitions well. We elect a new president. We change office. And it's legitimate from the public standpoint, and it is capable of reproducing itself, and it has done that for the last couple of hundred years. By contrast, China's system of governance, which is developing, it's experimental, it's emerging right now, doesn't yet have the proven capacity to generate that kind of long-term stability. They're working on that.
They just had a transfer of power.
They just had a transfer of power. They've actually had, you know, several transfers of power now. Every 10 years, they're basically turning over the entire senior leadership without elections through a very complicated internal system of committees promoting people, then other committees promoting those, and then ultimately the senior committee, the standing committee of the Politburo, deciding how it replaces itself. So that's an experimental new method of governance. It's not clear how well it functions. It has some benefits, clearly. It allows long-range planning. Some of the best people are brought in and some of the worst people are knocked out. But it also has disadvantages. It's open to corruption. The so-called princelings, people whose parents were important players in the older part of the Communist Party.
They own chunks of that economy now.
They own huge chunks of the economy. And as the public gradually realizes this, the public will be uncertain. And, you know, other countries around the world are not rushing to adopt the Chinese system of government right now. Democracy still remains the desideratum for most countries around the world. It doesn't mean it always works well. If you look at the Arab Spring, once countries got rid of their dictatorships, they all said, we want democracy. And it's one thing to say it. And as we see in Egypt, it's quite another thing actually to get it. But nobody said, well, let's replicate the structure of the Chinese Communist Party.
Well,
so that's
maybe some corners of Africa these days. I mean, John McCain, when he was running for president, or I believe it was in that period, said, we need a new league of democracies to stand up for to stand for something other than just a power play, maybe in opposition to China. What about that?
I think it's hugely important, and I think it's an option that we will probably come back to. It may not be called the League of Democracies, but you know, this struggle between the U.S. and China is only ideological on our side. The Chinese government is totally pragmatic. They don't care if other people are democratic as long as they don't have to be democratic. They don't care about human rights, except perhaps in the sense that making the poorest people better off is a type of basis for providing greater human rights. But they don't want to have free speech. You know, they don't want to protect people from arbitrary arrest. We care about those things. That means that we have an ideological struggle with them, but they don't have an ideological struggle with us.
That's wild.
We need to use that as part of one of our tools. And in the long run, the goal should actually be to change China's values and to make China gradually more democratic. But, you know, the current Chinese Communist Party knows that if they open things up too much, they would collapse and they'd go the way that Russia went in the post-Soviet era. And there's no chance of them doing that right
now. Noah Feldman's new book is Cool War. Jack joins us from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. Just a question. with all the debt that China is buying every month from us, if we fire a shot into either a trade war or a cyber war, and they just stop showing up at our treasury note auctions, and interest rates go to 7%, and the financial markets freak out, and we go into a recession, haven't they already won?
Noah?
And isn't our federal deficit a big national security threat?
Jack, we've got it. What do you say, Noah?
I do think that our deficit in the long run is a national security threat. Of course, if we're running the deficit in the hopes of regenerating our economy, it's also, ironically, a tool for us. Having a debt is actually a tool for us in trying to become more competitive. So that goes to the deep economic debate about whether
it cranks it back up Keynesian style.
Exactly. And I take no position on that. That's the matter for serious economists to argue about it. Indeed, they do argue about it. It is true, however, I think the caller is absolutely right, that China has meaningful leverage over us by virtue of holding our debt. You know, it's not absolute. If they stopped buying treasury bonds and it affected the price, that would also affect China.
Right. You know, I mean, doesn't it cut both ways? You know, when you owe the bank $1 trillion, you've got some leverage on them too.
Yes, there's no question. It does run in both directions. We are too big to fail from a Chinese perspective. So there is leverage, but it is mutual leverage in both directions.
Carol in Menomet, Massachusetts. Carol, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
What do you make of China buying the largest meat producer in the world, which was announced today, and also buying up water sources and looking ahead 50, 100,000 years about feeding the world?
Carol, thanks. Smithfield Pork, I think, a very big purchase announced today. China's buying all kinds of things. Does this make the relationship tip more toward some kind of partnership rather than conflict?
I see acquisitions like the Smithfield acquisition, more than a $7 billion firm, as very positive because it means that China is acknowledging that to feed itself, it needs to look outside. The same is true for China acquiring resources, natural resources, outside of China. They know they've degraded their resources, which is a separate problem. They have serious environmental challenges. They need to do something
separate,
about
but those. Not entirely. Carol hints at resource wars.
Yeah. Well, resource wars are a real possibility. There could be a struggle over resources, and certainly China's expansion in Africa is in some vague way reminiscent of the resource grabs of the 19th century in which Europe was engaged
European
in the same sort of
colonial
process.
Powers,
although, again, it's interesting that the Chinese do this in a very pragmatic way. They don't pretend that they're there to help the Africans. They just make it very clear that this is a
Here's
deal
the money,
to be done.
Give us your resources.
Yeah, which may not matter from the standpoint of Africans. We don't really know yet. But, you know, those kinds of ties make it harder, not easier, for China to be in conflict with the United States. You know, if China, if a Chinese firm has acquired an enormous, Western-based firm, they have a larger economic stake in the success of that firm. That's right. That's their pork supply. And it's also a business for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as though Smithfield is suddenly going to shift selling all of its pork to China. To the contrary,
it'll
continue to be a global player. So that kind of economic interdependence is, on the whole, I think, a good thing. And I'm not one of those people who feels terrified of China buying U.S. or other Western-based firms. I think that's basically a positive thing because it helps us manage the conflict.
That may be a way toward this peaceful future. Ira in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Ira, you're on the air.
I have a question going back to an earlier portion of the conversation. Mm-hmm. One of the most ephemeral sorts of secrets, this has to do with cybersecurity.
Yes.
Most ephemeral sorts of secrets are military secrets. And it's my impression that every 2 to 3 years, no matter what we do, these secrets get out. I mean, the greatest example of it would have been the compromise of the atomic bomb in 1949 to the Russians, when
right.
we thought it was going to take years and years.
Right.
Is there any way, although the means of getting at things may have changed somewhat, is there any real way of protecting military secrets from getting out? That's a question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Ira. Military secrets, and maybe right along with that, technological advantage. They're sort of one and the same these days.
I think it's a profound point that if you're in an arms race with the other side and if they're engaged full time in the business of trying to steal your secrets, they will eventually be able to steal a significant number of those secrets. The question is how long the whole process takes. And there was a time when stealing the plans for a piece of technology didn't get you very far towards building that technology, especially if your industry was way behind.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live in that world anymore.
Right.
You know, China is capable in the private sector, as we know.
Super rapid engineering and gear up.
Mm-hmm. Copying and building anything we can produce, including stealing intellectual property of private firms. So if they can do it there...
Which has happened, we're told, on a massive scale.
Exactly. So if they can do it there, they can certainly do it in the national defense sphere as well. And so, you know, since, as the caller points out, eventually you lose your secrets, the reason you try to develop newer technology and greater secrets is to get an advantage in the interim.
But can you keep that advantage for 5 seconds,
exactly,
for 5 months, for 5 years?
Yeah, exactly. As the time frame shrinks, the asymmetric effects of the theft of technology become tremendous. And that's the situation that I think it's legitimate to fear that we're moving towards. It's hard to imagine today anyone in any industry saying, well, I have this product, but I couldn't possibly build that product in China. You could. You name a product, somebody in China could tool up and manage to build it. And that's going to be true of defense technology the same way it's true of private technology.
Senya asks on Twitter, where is Russia in all of this today?
You know, when Xi Jinping took over officially as president, his first trip was not to visit President Obama. His first trip was actually to visit Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. And that was because increasingly China needs Russia and Russia needs China as counterbalancing allies against the United States. And we see this, for example, in the Security Council, where it's China and Russia together blocking serious sanctions or intervention against Bashar al-Assad in Syria, because they have a common interest in avoiding Western attacks that would, you know, enter the sovereign space of Syria, assuming it's still sovereign, mm-hmm, and fundamentally change the situation there, because that would strengthen the West and the United States, and therefore, by association, it would weaken them. So those alliances between China and Russia are coming up increasingly frequently. So I think, you know, much in the same way that during the Cold War, the United States turned to China in order to isolate and weaken the Soviet Union, it now makes sense from China's perspective to reach out to Russia. And, you know, eventually Russia will try to play that against the middle and try to deepen its relationship with Washington as well. I mean, from Russia's perspective, mm-hmm, they would like to sell out only the highest bidder.
Yep. Sam in West Branch, Iowa. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I want to comment. You know, I think we're dealing in a world of cyber knowledge. And, you know, and part of it's a great opportunity. Our biggest export right now, or the mother load, is Chinese students who come to our universities. Our university here is full of them. And they're very smart kids, because they got a lot of smart kids.
Yeah.
Just a lot of...
Big country.
And so they go back home. Apple manufactures them. And, you know, in part of we're fighting a phantom here, because we should be celebrating the fact that these kids go back home, but we ought to teach them also about democracy, the values, get them involved, that kind of thing. And so they're... Socialism morphs to capitalism. And incidentally, maybe we ought to start taking a look at what they're doing and start morphing our capitalism a little more socialistic and solve some of our infrastructure problems in this country. So anyway, I think it's a win-win situation if we look at it from that standpoint, because we've got universities are packed with young Chinese kids, and they don't get their brains raced when they go home.
Yeah, Sam, I'm very warm toward the flexibility of your mind here, the openness of it. I mean, no, that's a good point to turn toward. You call it cool war, but it's got that war word in there. But you also describe a scenario in which this becomes, I mean, Xi Jinping described it in his phrase, a new type of great power relationship. Sam nods toward that. We're educating each other's young people. A lot of Americans in China these days, too. If this could go to the positive, what would that look like? What kind of relationship would this be, and what would the benefits be?
I think it would begin with culture, just as the caller was saying. You know, with 200,000 Chinese students in the U.S. and perhaps 80,000 Americans living in China, this is not the Cold War in that respect. You know, we understand them increasingly well, and they understand us extremely well. You know, the new premier speaks terrific English. You know, there is a greater degree of mutual comprehension than there was during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. In a positively developing relationship, what would happen, I think, is that we could develop a partnership with respect to security, where the United States would maintain probably the dominant role, but where it would be respectful of China's desire to express itself, perhaps to some degree within Asia, and where economically we would deepen our ties even further and make trade even a more fundamental aspect of our relationship, and not simply that we buy their products and they lend us money. That's in the long run not that functional from our standpoint.
Yeah.
We want them to buy our products. We want to make things that they're capable of buying, and that means, among other things, that China has to agree to enforce intellectual property rights, because a lot of what we produce, pharmaceuticals, films, you know, high tech mm-hmm. requires the other side not to steal your ideas.
Can't just steal it, gotta
buy it. Exactly. So if that were to happen on a deeper level, we could actually have a more beneficial relationship. And, you know, one very concrete example of this is the agreements on both sides and throughout the world to follow international trade law. You know, international law has sometimes been derided as not really being very legal, but trade law is very legal in that mm-hmm. people follow it, and if a tribunal says they've broken it, mm-hmm. yeah, people pay their penalty. Countries pay their penalties. And the reason they do that is very straightforwardly self-interest. Everyone has more to gain by staying inside the trade relationship.
We've just got a minute left, but so it takes us to the heart of this. I mean, it depends, it would ultimately depend on these two cultures being capable of sharing great eminence on the planet, because China is going to be enormously eminent. The United States is already. Do you see in these cultures that capacity to say, well, maybe 1,000 years ago people, you know, fought to the death and only one could rule, but we're in a new era, it's global, and we can share this? Do you see that in the Chinese? Do you see it in Americans?
I think it is a possibility. I think a cool war could end well for everybody because of a pragmatism that both sides share. China is a commercial power ultimately, mm-hmm. and the United States got its start as a commercial power. We were only dragged, you know, almost against our wills into World War I and to World War II. Mm-hmm. We're an accidental superpower in that sense. And so for that reason, I think the fundamental pragmatism of the American people and the fundamental pragmatism of the Chinese people could actually find common ground, especially if over time China gradually improves the status of human rights for its citizens and engages in serious political reform that would take away the ideological barrier between the countries. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in the short term. It is a possibility over time.
We will watch extremely closely as the Chinese President Xi Jinping and Barack Obama, U.S. President, sit down next week in California. You've given us a great framework for looking at that meeting, Noah Feldman. The new book is Cool War, The Future of Global Competition, and he's talking the United States and China. Noah Feldman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
Great excerpt of the book at our website. Check it out, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rose, and Eileen Amata, Emily Alpin Johnson, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Abigail Collins, Jessica Kern, and Chiquita Pascal. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Find my tweets at Tom Ashbrook NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.